Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Harvey P. Sackett, appearing on behalf of Cassie Benson.
If you could speak up a little bit, it would be useful.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Harvey P. Sackett on behalf of Cassie Benson. Following reversal and remand by the district court of the first of two unfavorable decisions, a second administrative law judge again found Ms. Benson not disabled. The focus of my argument concerns the ALJ's assessment of Ms. Benson's four severe impairments. The ALJ stated prior to December 31, 2013 expiration of Ms. Benson's date last insured, quote, the medical records are inconsistent with disability, unquote. Benson argues the record does not support this. I start with the two consultative examinations of Dr. Weems and Dr. Martin.
Can I ask you a quick question based on my recollection from when I did Social Security cases as before I took senior status? These consulting physicians, they're picked by the agency.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is that true? They're not like treating physicians or anyone whom the Social Security beneficiary picked.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
In the case of Dr. Weems, state agency ordered her examination prior to the initial administrative hearing, as opposed to Dr. Martin, who saw Benson pursuant to the district court order, which said that further examination was needed. As a result, state agency sought to have Dr. Martin examine Ms. Benson. What's interesting about the scenario here is that typically the conflict is between the opinions of state agency evaluators and the treaters. However, the primary conflict here is between the opinions of non-examining state agency evaluators and the consultative examinations of Dr. Weems and Dr. Martin. As noted, they were both ordered by the state agency and the commissioner. This scenario is what the court saw in Ryan versus commissioner. That's mentioned in my 28-J letter. For both of these reports and others I will discuss shortly, the ALJ focused much of his analysis and findings on their observations or mental status examinations, rather than considering the additional factors that led to the conclusions as to Benson's functional limitations.
Is it clear how much he actually focused? I mean, at some point he said he was giving them limited weight, and at another point he said he was giving it some weight. What are we to make of that?
Judge Corman, in both situations, he gave these reports limited weight or some weight, as you note, because he again defaulted time and time again to the mental status examinations and the doctor's respective observations. In both instances, the ALJ on remand failed to mention a multitude of other things that each doctor had done in assessing Ms. Benson. For example, in the case of Dr. Weems, she conducted past psychiatric history, medical history, family social history, and employment histories. The ALJ did not mention this. Dr. Weems also indicated that she rarely did chores. She did laundry once or twice a month. She became very anxious around crowds. She had lost her jobs because of absences. She has to reread things, and she had some suicidal ideation. And Ms. Benson stays in bed most of the day. Only then did Dr. Weems first give a mental status examination assessment. And this is what the ALJ left out, which is critical. In concluding, Dr. Weems said that Benson would have difficulty maintaining focus. She would have to have instructions repeated to her in the work environment. She would have difficulty maintaining attendance, and she would have poor stress tolerance. She would become easily overwhelmed and have difficulty getting through the workday. Similarly, Dr. Martin conducted his psychological evaluation of Ms. Benson in January 2018. Again, this was done by order of the Appeals Council pursuant to the District Court's remand order in May 2017. This was the entire reason why she was sent to see Dr. Morton. And as I noted, the case was previously mandated by the district court because the initial hearing decision, the ALJ determined there was no severe impairment. This time around, the ALJ found Ms. Benson had established severe impairments, but he rejected Dr. Martin's conclusions. The ALJ further discounts Dr. Martin's opinion because he examined Ms. Benson 4 years after her date last insured. This is disingenuous. The commissioner cannot have it both ways. First ordering Dr. Martin's examination pursuant to the district court's remand, and then turning around saying, well, we're now going to discount it because it comes too late. And to further underscore the point how Dr. Martin reached his conclusions, the form state agency directed him to complete says, quote, the opinion should be based on your findings with respect to medical history, clinical and laboratory findings, diagnosis, prescribed treatment, and response to prognosis, unquote. That's exactly what Dr. Martin did.
Can I interrupt for just a minute? I have Dr. Martin's report in front of me. What part of Dr. Martin's report do you rely on for your conclusion that Dr. Martin has concluded that she's incapable of performing qualifying work?
Certainly, Judge Fletcher. Dr. Martin first reviewed all of her records. He then stated he conducted a, quote, complete psychological evaluation. He then administered a battery of three psychological tests, the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale, the Wechsler Memory Scale, and the Trail-Making Test. And then, like with Dr. Weems, only then did he conduct a mental status examination. He indicated while Benson presented in a friendly and cooperative fashion, she appeared quite anxious. Ultimately, based on all these factors, Your Honor, his diagnostic impression was that Ms. Benson suffered from a major depressive disorder, a generalized anxiety disorder, and a somatic disorder. Insofar as her limitations work-wise, he stated that she was markedly impaired insofar as her ability to complete a normal workday, as well as being markedly impaired to deal with the usual stresses of work.
I'm with you here. I'm reading work-related abilities. He's got a list of nine. Performing simple repetitive tasks, not significantly limited. Performing detailed complex tasks, mildly limited. Maintaining regular attendance, moderately limited. Ability to perform work activities consistent basis, moderately limited. Ability to perform work activities without special or distant supervision, mildly limited. Ability to complete normal workday or work week without interruptions, markedly limited. You quoted that correctly. Ability to accept instruction from supervisors, mildly limited. Ability to interact with coworkers and the public, mildly limited. Ability to deal with usual stresses encountered in competitive work environment, markedly limited. As I read all of those, am I supposed to conclude or must I conclude that she's incapable of performing qualifying work?
That's correct, Your Honor, because those two marked limitations alone would preclude her from performing the baseline or least common denominator of work, meaning simple repetitive tasks with little involvement with other persons, meaning coworkers, supervisors, or the public.
I've looked at the VE testimony. What would you point to in this record that establishes what you just said, that with those limitations you can't work?
Certainly. Judge Miller, when on cross-examination, the VE was asked if somebody had a marked limitation, again, insofar as dealing with stress and staying on task for a loss of at least 20% of the time, the VE responded that nobody could perform competitive work. And that's what I rely on, that particular cross-examination. If the panel has no other questions, I respectfully will reserve my balance of my time.
Could I ask you about her, the various indications in the record that she had pain, and she was treated for it, and she was on painkillers. Are you arguing, or if you're not, why not, that the combination of the two would be a relevant consideration?
It certainly would be, Your Honor, because the administrative law judge had to consider not the most significant impairment, but all impairments in combination. So yes, her chronic pain syndrome in combination with her mental limitations certainly would enhance her inability to work. So I'm not basing my entire argument simply on the mental impairments, but there is clearly the most predominant. And by themselves, again, without precluding the consideration of chronic pain, she would be disabled from all types of work.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, let's hear from the government, and we'll make sure to give you a chance to respond.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're muted.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry about that. May it please the Court, Daniel Talbert for the Acting Commissioner of Social Security, Kilolo Kijakazi. The claimant has challenged a number of factual findings in the administrative law judge's decision, but substantial evidence supports those findings, and the ALJ's decision is free of reversible legal error. Therefore, the government asks the Court to affirm the ALJ's decision.
Let me start out with a question. I'm sorry, Judge Carman, please go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
The other side contends that if the reports of Dr. Martin and of Dr. Williams are fully credited, she's disabled. Do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor, I don't. I'd like to make kind of a two-part response to that question. First, I'll address it most directly, that we don't agree that those opinions by themselves establish disability.
That's not my question. I'm asking you, if those two reports accurately describe what she can and cannot do, is she disabled?
No, I don't. I think if the Court finds that there's error in evaluating those opinions, we would need further clarification of specifically what those limitations mean in a work setting and vocational expert testimony about the effect of that.
Yeah,
but although we don't agree that the ALJ erred in evaluating them.
Was one of the questions you could, it's hard to keep all the facts in this case in mind, but wasn't one of the questions of the vocational expert dependent on these two, her ability to work a full work week and to accommodate to a work environment? And if that's true, wouldn't the vocational expert's testimony require a finding of disability?
So I would say no, Your Honor. My understanding is that the vocational expert testified that someone who is off task, I'm looking up here, 15% of the time or 20% of the time, or needed to have instructions repeated, those might establish disability, but neither Dr. Martin nor Dr. Weems said that the claimant had those specific restrictions.
You mean in terms of percentages?
Yes.
In other words, the fact that she couldn't work a full week or that she couldn't accommodate herself to a work environment, if they had put it in percentages that coincided with the question that was put to the VE expert, that would be enough.
Well, I'm going to push back on the thought that that would be enough, but I guess if we're going from the perspective of saying that the ALJ erred, which again, we don't concede, and I'd like to talk about that in a moment if I can, but if the Court found error in those opinions, and those opinions specifically articulated what level of limitation there was and said the claimant would be off task X percent of the time, or the claimant couldn't do certain things, maybe those opinions could establish disability. But they don't say that.
Well, they don't say it and they don't not say it. So what would you suggest, that a remand to clarify that?
I would suggest that the Court affirm the ALJ's decision because the ALJ properly rejected those opinions. If the Court disagrees, then a remand would be necessary to clarify that. But I don't think we need to even reach that point because the ALJ reasonably rejected those opinions. In addition to what we have in our brief about that, and I think this is probably in the brief, but I think I could most plainly articulate why the ALJ reasonably disagreed with Dr. Weems and Dr. Martin's opinions to the extent that they suggested greater limitations. That finding the ALJ found that they were inconsistent with their own examinations. And that's the data that those doctors who were examining sources had. They personally examined the claimant. They did mental status examinations. They did cognitive testing in Dr. Martin's case. And that was the basis they had for assessing limitations. And the ALJ said, well, those examinations, those findings were largely normal. And that's not consistent with any marked limitations or other difficulties that are beyond what the ALJ found here. Now, that was a reasonable interpretation of the record, not just because the ALJ is the fact finder and he is free to kind of compare the opinions to what the examinations showed, but because by my count, we have really four people that basically agreed with the ALJ's interpretation of that. The first person is state agency psychologist Dr. Fitzpatrick, who reviewed the records at the initial stage, and her opinion, she said Dr. Weems's assessment was largely unremarkable. That's on page 60 of the certified administrative record. Dr. Schumacher, another psychologist who's also an expert in disability programs, on page 75 of the administrative record said Dr. Weems's examination largely unremarkable. When this case went up to district court the first time, the magistrate judge affirmed the ALJ's rejection of Dr. Weems's opinion along similar lines, and that's on pages, sorry, I lost my notes here, 617 and 618 of the certified administrative record. And then, of course, the district judge in this underlying case who affirmed the ALJ's decision also accepted the ALJ's interpretation of the record. So we have two state agency psychologists who are experts in disability programs who are saying that when a consultative examiner makes essentially normal findings but says, oh, there's all these difficulties, it's reasonable for the fact finder, the ALJ, to say, okay, that's not consistent, that's not supported. And then we have two judges from the district court that accepted that same kind of finding. So our position is that the ALJ's rejection of Dr. Weems and Dr. Martin, based on those essentially benign examination findings, was entirely reasonable and easily satisfies the deferential substantial evidence standard. So for those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm the ALJ's rejections of those portions of the examining source's opinions and not even need to reach the point of what further proceedings would be necessary, because none are necessary. The court should simply affirm.
Can you say a bit about what exactly the inconsistency is between the mental status findings and the other findings? Because, I mean, I'm looking at Weems, for example, and the mental status examination, you know, says a bunch of things that really don't, I mean, it seems like they're that and the findings about limitations in focus and distraction and needing to have instructions repeated, they seem to be addressing two different things. So it's not clear to me how they're inconsistent. Can you clarify that?
Well, so Your Honor, I would say, and I apologize for kind of repeating myself, but we aren't any of us doctors or experts in mental health or disability programs the way that people like Dr. Fitzpatrick and Dr. Schumacher, whom I mentioned just a few moments ago, are. And they said that this is a largely unremarkable examination that is not consistent with the limitations that Dr. Weems assessed. So I think it's reasonable to defer to what those experts said. But if we want to go beyond that, I could just note the mental status exam. I mean, if we read it, it's, and then the intellectual function, all the portions of it, it's basically normal. I mean, I think that what Dr. Fitzpatrick and Dr. Schumacher said makes sense. Again, we should defer to them because they're experts in this. But if we look at it for ourselves, we could see there's nothing particularly abnormal other than the fact that the claimant didn't do a great job of subtracting by sevens from 100, which is what we call serial sevens.
Yeah, you know, as I look at the gestalt of this case, we have a young woman who's struggled with obesity all of her life. At the last date on which I've got numbers, 2012, she's 5'5.5" tall, and she weighs 340 pounds. She's never married. She lives at home with her parents. She has limited mobility. She lost her last job because she had attendance problems. It was some kind of a paralegal job. This woman strikes me, as I look at the entire record, as essentially unlikely given her physical limitations and her unquestioned history of depression as likely to be unemployable. She may be sufficiently intelligent to pass, you know, spell the word world backwards, But that's really not the entire question as to whether or not she's sitting at still taking a test about intellectual capacity. The question is, can she, if you look at the entire package, do the work? And my sense, I mean, I've seen so many of these cases, I can't even count anymore. This one is, you know, this woman looks pretty disabled to me.
Well, Your Honor, the point I would make is that, I mean, I think the overarching point is that we need to look at this from the perspective of the ALJ as the fact finder. And although we may disagree with the ALJ's characterization, the question is whether it's a rational or possible interpretation of the record. And I want to point out that with respect to the physical impairments, which addresses the obesity, the pain, and all those other limitations, I believe that all of the doctors who gave assessments about her physical functioning said that she was able to perform at least the level of work that the ALJ found. So that's what the doctors are saying. You know, this claimant may be obese. She may have certain objective findings and other limitations, but the doctors, who again are the experts on these things,
well, I'm, of course, that's not the only factor. I'm also looking at the reports of severe depression. There are a parent's report, and there's no dispute that this is an accurate report. Many days she basically doesn't get out of bed. I mean, we're talking about a woman who's having very severe difficulties and has had them for a very long time.
So if I could talk about the depression, the mental health issues, my reading of this record is that the claims that she spends most of the time in bed is that she's attributing that almost entirely to pain. But to the extent that we're talking about the depression affecting that, I would go back to the ALJ's very specific findings about her testimony about mental health limitations, not just the ALJ's discussion of Dr. Weems and Dr. Martin, whom the ALJ reasonably agreed with in large part, but not entirely because, again, their findings were mostly normal, but also the ALJ's fairly detailed discussion of mental status examinations throughout the record, his discussion of the claimant's course of treatment for depression, which was fairly limited, but when she complied with it, when she had this treatment, it was effective. And I think the ALJ talks about this on pages 497 to 500 of the certified administrative record in particular. And the ALJ notes also a number of the claimant's activities, including going out and volunteering at an animal shelter. I mean, there's other things too.
Now, I'm sure you know this. She volunteers at the animal shelter for 3 hours on Sundays and sometimes has to leave because the stress is too much. So if that's an evidence that she can work, I'm afraid there's not much evidence that she can work coming out of that.
Well, Your Honor, that's part of the evidence. I wouldn't rest my entire case on that.
I wouldn't if I were you.
No, I just said I'm not, Your Honor. But the entire point is that is plainly inconsistent with the claim that she has to be in bed 98 to 99% of the time. But even putting that aside, the ALJ has other specific findings. I would urge the court to look especially at pages 497 to 500 of the certified administrative record, to look at the ALJ's very specific findings on pages, I think it's 501 and 502, about specific testimony, and to consider what the state agency doctors said about the examinations, what the record overall shows in terms of opinions demonstrating the claimant is capable of performing a significant range of work that's at least consistent with what the ALJ found, and to consider that all under the deferential substantial evidence standard and determine that the ALJ's findings are reasonable, they are at least one plausible interpretation of this record, and to therefore affirm the ALJ's decision.
Okay, any further questions from the bench?
In terms of deference to the ALJ, are there any disputed issues of fact that he is in a particularly good position to resolve?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say respectfully just about everything, that the ALJ is the fact finder. It's basically the trial proceedings.
But if everybody agrees the sun is shining, then the sun is either shining or it's not. The question I'm asking is there anything, is he relying on any resolution of disputed issues of fact?
Well, I think there's conflicting opinion evidence to some extent, and there are conflicts between the claimant's allegations and the record that the ALJ discussed at some length. So
the problems that I have with some of that is that, for example, you know, he says he gives some weight to Weems and Martin, but I don't know what that means. And the same thing is true with respect to what he says about the state examiner, the state examiners. He says, you know, some weight, light weight, but it's not exactly clear. It's a sort of, he's giving him enough weight just to find that she's not disabled.
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I mean, the ALJ makes a specific residual functional capacity finding, and he says what the claimant is able to do. He finds the claimant limited, largely consistent with what Dr. Martin and Dr. Weems said, and I can go one by one through certain things if the court wants to do that. I realize I'm well over my time, but I'm happy to continue answering any questions the panel has.
Terry went through that with Judge Fletcher, yeah, and came to two where they were marked disabilities, her ability to work a full work week and her ability to accommodate herself to the workplace.
Yes, Your Honor. And the ALJ found those inconsistent with, again, the normal findings that those doctors made on examination, just as the state agency doctors assessed and as the two judges from the district court essentially agreed that there was that inconsistency, which permitted the ALJ to make that finding.
Okay. Any further questions for the government? Mr. Sackett, let's put 2 minutes on the clock. We took the government well over time, so you just say what you need to say. You're still muted. You're muted. Push the button. You're muted.
I apologize, Your Honor. Can you hear me now?
Well, if you speak up, I can.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Several points. First, I want to go back to Judge Miller's question about the correlation between the VE's testimony and being off task 15 or 20%. That testimony can be seen at CAR 559 and 565. In conjunction with that, the form that Dr. Martin was asked to complete defined the word marked. And in that form, the word marked is defined as a serious limitation in this area. So I don't think it's a leap of faith to say that a 15 or 20% deficit is any higher than a marked limitation. Opposing counsel keeps going back to the term normal and observations. And that's where the argument falls short, because a mental status examination is a diagnostic tool. It is not intended to assess a doctor's statement of limitations. It's not intended to assess how the person would function insofar as the need to work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. Opposing counsel also keeps going back to state agency. Well, again, this is what we saw in Ryan, where the commissioner kept defaulting back to the opinions of state agency physicians and psychologists, saying they're experts, but they gave little, if the appropriate amount of weight to the assessment of their own consulting psychologists. That is what we have here. One final point, and I don't intend to be presumptuous. There's been some discussion about what the remedy might be. Using the three-pronged credit is true rule from Harmon, it's Benson's position that there's no need to send this case back. There's no further evidence that can be compiled. Her date last insured was 2013, so there's no new evidence out there. Secondly, if the evidence were credited as true, meaning the VE's testimony, the limitations of marked by both Dr. Weems and Dr. Martin, the only conclusion that can be reached is that Benson's disabled. As a result of that, remand for further administrative proceedings would be a waste of resources and time.
Well, not all of the there were reports as late as 2017 or 2018, weren't there, on the second remand?
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, those were, again, after the date last insured. So given the marker of 12/31/13, the critical report first is that of Dr. Weems. Dr. Martin's report simply mirrors that of Dr. Weems. So the point being that nothing really changed over the course of 6 years. And that's why going back for another administrative hearing is not going to be productive. These questions have already been resolved, and the record is clear on all of these issues. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank both sides for their arguments. The case just argued is now submitted.